The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Real Estate Commission Appellant versus Robert Leonard Appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Lindsay Ryder Rapp and Mr. Robert Ryder. And Ms. Rapp, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And for the appellee, Leonard, we have Ms. Heather Lammers Bogart, attorney from Rapid City. With that, Ms. Ryder Rapp, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gilbertson and other members of the court, Ms. Lammers. My name is Lindsay Ryder, and I'm an attorney here in Pierre, and I'm here today along with my co-counsel, Robert Ryder, representing the South Dakota Real Estate Commission. The reason we are here today is not because of a technical violation of the law. The reason we are here is because the South Dakota Real Estate Commission, as a regulatory body for the state of South Dakota, is charged with protecting the public's interest. Along with that charge is also ensuring that the licensees that the Real Estate Commission oversees, that they act in compliance with the law. And this is particularly important because the public is not always armed with the same understanding of the laws as the licensee is. The facts involved in this case are relatively undisputed. We would ask the court to review the matter de novo, as the issue is the legal effect of the assignment. Although the facts are relatively undisputed, I think it's important to have an understanding of the events that transpired, and more particularly, the relationship between the parties. This case involved the sale of approximately 22 acres of ranch land in Pennington and Meade County that was owned by Walter Dale Miller and listed with Gary Niederwerder, who was the owner and broker of Rapid Realty. Mr. Leonard was an agent of that same office, and he actually represented Rusty Ingesser, who entered into the original purchase agreement on the property under a limited agency agreement. And I think that's important that I point that out, that it was a limited agency agreement. A limited agency agreement is created when the licensee represents both the buyer and the seller. And a licensee may only act in this capacity if there is informed written consent from all parties to the transaction. Ultimately, Mr. Ingesser was not able to complete the purchase of this property, so Mr. Leonard discussed with Daniel Woken, who was one of the surviving principals of Western Dakota Land LLC, the possibility of either getting an assignment of the lease or doing a backup offer on the purchase. In fact, Leonard actually even arranged a meeting between Western and Rusty Ingesser. Western ultimately acquired Ingesser's right to purchase the property, and that was pursuant to the assignment that is at issue here. However, prior to assuming the assignment, Western believed that Leonard was actually representing their interest. However, Leonard maintains that he was not Western's agent, nor did he owe him any fiduciary duties until after the assignment was completed, or after the assignment of the purchase agreement. The important fact here is that Leonard undertook representation of Western without executing any kind of agency agreement. In fact, at no time, either before or after the assignment, did Leonard ever discuss the nature of the relationship with Western or any other parameters of the representation which is required under South Dakota law.
Let me just ask you a question on the standard of review here. What you want us to do is to affirm the agency's decision, correct?
Correct.
So why are we doing that de novo?
The trial court determined that by virtue of the assignment, that the agency agreement was also assigned. So I believe that is the issue before this court, and it's a question of law that should be reviewed de novo.
So there's nothing to remand to the circuit court. You just want the agency's decision enforced.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
The only issue that did not get addressed at the trial court level was the issue of the cost and the fine that was assessed, which was also an issue that was raised by Mr. Leonard.
But that would go back to the agency, not to the circuit court.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I guess under, they argued that the trial court should address that issue. So I don't know if it, I would argue that it should be remanded. So for that particular issue. The only agreement that was ever executed that defined the parties' relationship with one another was the original agency agreement. And that was not between Mr. Wolkin and Mr. Leonard. That agreement was specifically between Rapid Realty and Rusty Ingesser. And again, that reflected the limited agency relationship. Leonard maintained...
The assignment, though, does include, does mention that there's an agency, though, doesn't it?
Justice Koenigkamp, the actual... If you would just ask the question and repeat the question, I'm sorry,
you're saying, I mean, you're saying that the issue here is, does the assignment of the purchase agreement include the assignment of the agency agreement? And I understand that Mr. Walken didn't sign any agency agreement, but was the assignment that he signed, the purchase agreement, the sign of the purchase agreement, did that refer to the agency agreement?
The actual assignment, the language in the assignment, it talks about the... Just make sure I have that in front of me. The actual assignment speaks to assigning all of the rights, privileges, and obligations as set forth thereinto. And we would argue that would be as set forth thereinto to the purchase agreement. And if you look at the purchase agreement, it does reference that they had reviewed the agency disclosure statement. But the agency disclosure statement merely discusses the different kinds of agency relationships that are available under the law. That's not the actual contract. And so that would be our argument, that it, while it does discuss the agency disclosure, it does not address the contract itself. That was a separate agreement that was entered into between Mr. That particular agency agreement that was entered into between Mr. Engesser and Mr. Leonard, not Mr. Wolken and Mr.
Leonard. Well, did Mr. Leonard expect that the provisions of the agency agreement that benefited him, such as a commission, that they were going to be honored by Mr. Wolken or his firm?
You know, and I don't know if that's clear. There were some questions that were asked of him in front of the administrative body, and I think that under his theory, any contractual rights that were entered into between he and Mr. Engesser translated to Mr. Wolken.
So he would still get his commission is what I guess the bottom line here. He understood he would get his commission from Mr. Wolken and his firm. Or from the transaction.
I don't believe it was actually Mr. Wolken that ultimately...
Right, it would be the seller.
Right.
But from the transaction, he would get his commission.
Sure. Yes. Mr. Leonard maintains that a new agency agreement wasn't required because the assignment by its very terms assigned the agreement. However, the problem with that argument is that the law clearly provides that an agency agreement must be in writing. And that is clearly set forth in 3621A130 that says that when a broker represents a buyer, it shall be in writing. And it contains some other information that must be included. And it also says that the licensee who obtains the agreement shall give the person signing a copy of the agreement, which clearly didn't happen here. Along with that is also the requirement that under a limited agency relationship where the licensee represents both the buyer and the seller, that there has to be informed written consent. And that clearly did not happen here.
How do you address the question that Mr. Wolken did not complain about this issue that now that the commission has taken it?
I think the commission, as the regulatory body, I mean, the commission has the authority to file complaints. So even though a person may not come to the commission and file a complaint and ask the commission to look into it, there is authority for the commission to file a complaint on its own. It's a regulatory body, like I said, and it has a duty to ensure that its licensees comply with the law. And there is clearly statute that mandates them to have this written agreement. And they didn't follow the directive. So I don't think, frankly, that it matters that he didn't complain, because I think Leonard's required to have this agreement under the law.
Are you saying that not only did Mr. Leonard not provide the disclosure, the required disclosure to Mr. Walken, but he didn't provide it even to Mr. Inges? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there was not testimony as far as at the administrative level. I don't think there was any testimony about what Mr. Inges was explained to him or what was not explained to him. He didn't testify at
the... You said before that the written disclosure that's required by the statute was not existent. Is that only applicable to Mr. Walken, or is that also applied to Mr. Inges?
I think it would apply to both. I mean, I don't think it was clear here, and that's part of the problem. I don't think it was clear to Mr. Walken at what point Mr. Leonard was representing him. I mean, he believed, actually, prior to the assignment even taking place, that Mr. Leonard was representing him. So in theory, Mr. Leonard was representing both of them. He was representing Mr. Engesser, and he was representing Mr. Walken prior to the assignment even taking place. I mean, he actually arranged a meeting between the parties, and Mr. Walken believed that he was representing him at that time, and that was long before the assignment even took place.
But commission did not find that there was a violation with respect to Mr. Engesser. The violation is only pertains to Mr. Walken and his firm.
That is correct. And as I said, and I think it's important because I think the statute's purpose is to make sure that, or part of the intent of the statute is to make sure that the buyer consumer is informed. I mean, they need to understand what their agent's obligations are. And clearly, Mr. Wolken did not understand duties Mr. Leonard owed to him, because there was never any discussion with him about that. Part of our argument is, of course, that a personal services contract of this nature is not properly assignable. And I think, you know, there is case law in South Dakota that was cited that actually discusses that very argument, that contracts that involve personal skill are not properly assignable. And I think that's particularly important when you have a relationship that is fiduciary in nature, like it is here. The case law supports that an agent owes a fiduciary duty to the client. And, I mean, it's just, I guess, the example that we used in our brief, I think, kind of hits home, and we use the analogy to an attorney-client relationship that is also fiduciary in nature. But if I had a contract action and I hired Chief Justice Gilbertson to represent me in that contract action, and then I assigned my right in the contract to Mr. Ryder, certainly Chief Justice Gilbertson should not be required to continue services to Mr. Ryder, nor should Mr. Ryder have to have Chief Justice Gilbertson as his attorney. So I think the analogy works because both relationships that are created are fiduciary in nature. I mean, a person goes to an attorney, a person goes to a particular realtor because of the particular skill set that person has and because they trust that person. So it would be our argument that a personal services contract such as this is not properly assignable because of the unique nature of the relationship, but more importantly, because of the statutory mandates. And I think that's kind of the overriding consideration throughout all of this is, I don't think that it's properly assignable because it's personal in nature, but even more so than that is the mandate from the statutes that require it to be in writing.
And the theory behind that is so that both sides understand who they're representing and what the duty is.
I believe so. And as Chief Justice Koninkamp, the question that he raised, and I think that's important too, is that...
Thank you for the promotion.
I'm sorry. But
he's always been the real power behind the throne.
Well, I think last time I was in front of this court, I called you the Chief Justice, so... but is the fact that the actual assignment, if you look at the terms of the assignment, it talks about, or it speaks to, again, I need to get a copy of it. It speaks to all of the rights, privileges, and obligations set forth therein too. And so to the purchase agreement itself would be our argument. And in the purchase agreement, there is no reference to this contract that was executed. And I think it's important, too, that this was a contract that was executed, a collateral document that was executed between two parties that were unrelated to the current transaction. So I think that's an important thing or important part of this discussion. If the court does not have any further questions,
I would not. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Lammers-Bogard, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I think Ms. Reiterapp was correct in that the facts are relatively undisputed. One small correction, I think she said that the transaction involved the amount of 200 acres was actually over 2,000 acres involved with this particular land transaction. It was for development purposes, more of a commercial transaction. And also, Justice Koninkamp, you had asked about Mr. Russell Angusser, and he did in fact receive copies of the agency documents. His signature is contained on the documents. Those are the only two clarifications I wanted to make.
So what documents, again, are you talking about?
The agency...
is that in one of the appendix, in one of your...
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. On my tabs, it would be...
Pardon me?
Appendix O.
Oh, okay.
And it's signed by Rusty Angusser, and that would have been in 2004, June 2004.
So this would have been the agency agreement addendum, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And this was signed by...
And I'm not clear why they call it an addendum, but it sets forth that there's the limited agencies where both buyer and seller are using Rapid Realty. But one thing that counsel didn't mention is where the trial court was wrong. And the trial court in this case didn't determine that any of the findings of fact were incorrect necessarily, so much as he considered all of the facts of the case. He considered more of the relevant facts than the agency considered. The trial court particularly recognized that the agency agreement issue, whether Mr. Wolkin had a signed new agency agreement, was never raised by Dan Wolkin. It just simply wasn't. He brought a lawsuit I believe 2005, and nowhere in that complaint, and certainly nowhere within the following multiple years of litigation in which I was involved, did this issue ever come up. Dan Wilkins simply had no problem with the agency agreement. He knew Bob Leonard was his realtor, and he was certainly experienced enough to say, Mr. Leonard, I've got a new realtor. I don't need you anymore, or I'm going to use a lawyer instead of a realtor. He never did that. Dan Wilkins' issue and his partner's issue had to do with 240 acres and these covenants that were attached to those acres. And they involved riding horses, and it became difficult for the property to sell because the homeowners in the surrounding area had the ability to ride their horses on this land. So they couldn't sell it. They wanted to turn it around quickly, and they couldn't sell it because of these 240 acres. That's where the lawsuit came from.
But does that really matter? I mean, doesn't the agency have the jurisdiction to look into other violations if they see them in the course of the investigation?
Sure, although I will note that the case that was cited by counsel, the Gottschalk versus Haig case, 1975, where they're saying supports the position that the commission can revoke a license, it's actually citing a statute that has been repealed. And Ms. Ryder-Rapp had commented that they're protecting the public. And perhaps under a different set of facts, that would exactly be the case. Here, clearly it's not. Mr. Wilkin knew what was going on, and he had no complaint about it.
You're saying it's a technical violation, and therefore it's no violation?
At the very most, it would be a technical violation. But Justice Konenkamp, it's our position that it's no violation at all because this was a valid assignment. And that was one other area of law that was recognized by the trial court that the agency completely ignored. First of all, can this type of agency agreement, can it be assigned? Is it assignable? And case law supports that it certainly can when there's consent of the parties. And in the example that opposing counsel gave with Chief Justice having a lawyer and having that assigned, certainly if all the parties agree, it's assignable. And that's exactly the situation here.
I'm just looking at this statute, and it's a disclosure statute, 3621A130, and it's paragraph, looks like the fourth paragraph. It says, when entering into an agency agreement, a broker shall provide a clear and complete explanation of the broker's representation of the interests of the seller or buyer. So when did your client provide a complete explanation, a clear and complete explanation of his representation?
My client provided that to Rusty Engesser. And when Rusty Engesser executed his assignment to Dan Wilkin, the agency agreement went along with that. It even says in the assignment, it makes a reference to, I'm assigning all of my interests in the purchase agreement and all the rights, et cetera, contained therein. Well, right at the very top of the first page of the purchase agreement, it states that there's been an agency disclosure. Now, certainly, if Mr. Wilkin gets the documents from Engesser pursuant to the assignment, he looks at that and says, well, I don't know about this agency agreement. Nobody ever told me about that. He could
but
have
that wasn't
that.
The tab. What Mr. Wilkin signed was the assignment of the purchase agreement and your reference to that. The agency agreement and the disclosure of the agency agreement wasn't attached to that, was it?
It wasn't attached, but it was certainly incorporated therein. And actually, Mr.
Wilkin. So then does that put the burden then on the customer, consumer then to go and find the disclosure, or doesn't the burden remain with the agent to make sure that his client gets the disclosure and this clear explanation that the statute requires?
I think that's an issue between the parties to the assignment, which would be Mr. Engesser and Mr. Wilkin. And Mr. Wilkin actually didn't sign the assignment. It was just signed by Rusty Engesser. And that's just how the transaction came
So you're out. Saying Mr. Engesser had the obligation to explain to Mr. Wilkin the relationship that he had with his broker?
Well, I'm saying it's a contract between the two of them. And if Mr. Wolkin didn't understand something in that contract, he should have sought counsel. He could have asked Bob Leonard.
You are saying then that the burden is on the consumer, the client then, to get this clear and complete explanation instead of the burden being on the broker to give it.
To a certain extent, Your Honor, but at the same time, I don't think it matters. And it may matter in a different set of facts, but here it doesn't. Even if we all assume that he should have gotten this new agency agreement, he should have had a conversation with Mr. Leonard about the agency relationship, there was no harm. There was nothing that ever happened incorrectly or inappropriately with regard to the agency agreement.
This isn't a lawsuit. This is a violation of a code of conduct, and you don't have to prove harm, do you?
Not necessarily, but as the trial court said, no harm, no foul. You know, it's difficult to look at the realtor who's been practicing for almost 40 years now and say, you know, you should have had this agency agreement, a new one signed, when clearly he was under the understanding that was similar to Dan Wolkin, that they all knew he was representing him. And I think you mentioned earlier, Justice Kohenkamp, that the transaction continued. After the assignment occurred, there was various information exchanged with regard to the boundary. There was a boundary dispute with regard to the covenants on the 240 acres. Maps were exchanged. They continued all the way through the closing, and not once did Mr. Wolkin say, you know, what are you doing here, Mr. Leonard? You're not my realtor. And Leonard even got a commission out of it, and no one ever made a complaint. Mr. Wolkin knew that Bob Leonard was representing him. He was experienced. Mr. Wolkin had been involved in multiple other commercial and residential land purchases. He certainly couldn't be considered, you know, new to the rodeo. He knew what he was doing.
The no harm, no foul argument, doesn't that go more to the consequence for violating the rule than to whether he violated the rule? Isn't that a little like saying, you know, the lawyer doesn't have a written contract with his client, but nonetheless the client wasn't harmed, so therefore there's no violation of the ethics code? That doesn't apply, does it?
Well, and certainly that was going to be one of my arguments towards the end, is that even if this court believes that there was no assignment and a new purchase agreement should have been executed, that still doesn't mean there was any violation. Particularly of SDCL 3621A71. There's no evidence of failure to promote the interests of Mr. Wolkin. There's no evidence of unfair dealing, and certainly no evidence of bad faith or fraud that came before this agency that would result in any sort of penalty or violation on behalf of Mr. Leonard.
But what about the requirements of providing a copy?
And it's our position, Your Honor, that he did, in fact, provide a copy. He provided a copy of the agency agreement to Rusty Angusser. And Rusty Angusser, with the assignment, would have given the whole file to to Dan Wolkin. And through that transaction, it was provided. There was a written agency agreement.
But again, it's the regulated professional's responsibility. Isn't it to provide the copy?
It is, and he did. You know, it's our position he did. And were it not for the assignment, you know, they would have continued through the transaction and none of us would be here today. But given that Rusty Angusser couldn't sell his property, he had to give the assignment to Dan Wolkin for a certain amount of money. And, you know, at that point, it just becomes a different ballgame. And it's something I think has never been before this court, with regard to the assignment of a purchase agreement and what may go with it. But I think if we look even way back in the Carter versus State case, which I realize is quite old, but at least at that point this court said that if there's knowledge of the assignment and there's no objection to the assignment, that's consent, and it's considered a valid assignment. And certainly we have inferred consent here. There was never any objection by Mr. Wolkin. He continued to receive information from Bob Leonard, as I mentioned. He never stated that he needed a different realtor. He closed on the property. Mr. Leonard made a commission. There was never an issue. Inferred consent, but also there's direct evidence of consent to the assignment. The assignment itself states in there, it's assigning all of my interests and rights in the purchase agreement. And again, the purchase agreement references the agency disclosure. And certainly there's no prohibition of an assignment in the purchase agreement, in the agency agreement, or even any of the statutes that bring us here today. There's nowhere in there that says you cannot assign an agency agreement. And certainly the case law supports that you're going to assign with it, with a document, anything that makes it effectual. And here, it makes it effectual to have the agency agreement follow the purchase agreement because Mr. Leonard is completing all the documentation. He's assisting with the ultimate closing on the property. But one point I want to make sure to make is this is also an example of ratification of the assignment. In the Amott versus Enobi case, which is a South Dakota 1984 case, they talk about where there's signing of documents, acknowledging the existence of a contract, receiving payment under the contract. That's ratification of the contract. And we absolutely have that in this circumstance.
Well, we really aren't talking about the contractual relationship here, are we?
Well, we're talking about...
talking about a requirement of the profession. And even if the contract would be enforceable, does that get the real estate, the realtor off the hook for not doing what he should have done according to the law?
Well, in this case, it is somewhat outside of the statute, statutes that pertain to... behavior of real estate agents because there was an assignment involved. And there isn't any specific statute within the realtor statutes that say what you need to do when there is an assignment. And to a certain extent, that's true. But I think also we really have to look at what an assignment does. And that's what the trial court did here. He considered the legal effect of an assignment, whereas the agency just flat ignored it. And there's no question that there was ratification here. And again, I could go through all of the behavior of Wilkin that ratified it. But here, I would ask you to consider that we're not here because Mr. Wilkin was confused about the agency agreement. And we're not here because Mr. Leonard failed to provide information to him or misrepresented something. We're here because the commission decided on its own, after receiving the file, that it was going to find a violation. It was determined to find a violation, whether it be of Gary Niederwerder or Bob Leonard. And they ended up having to go so far out that they're finding a violation that wasn't even a complaint of Dan Wilkin to begin with. And, you know, I can only compare that to if I were before the disciplinary committee and the complaint was that I stole a bunch of money from my client, and all of a sudden they're looking through the file and they say, well, you never had a fee agreement, and I get tagged for that. I think it's outside of their scope.
Well,
yes.
No, we've actually held that the commission, the disciplinary board, does have the authority, if it discovers violations, to pursue them.
Well, that was a bad example then.
Want to try again?
Yeah, I'll go back to my point that... yes, they do have the job of protecting the public, but this case is not an example of protecting the public. This is the commission going on its own, determined to find a violation.
Was there a due process issue here where Mr. Leonard didn't get a chance to actually respond to this particular problem, or did he get a chance to respond?
That is another one of my arguments, Justice Konenkamp, that he did not have full due process because, again, it wasn't in the complaint. The commission complaint actually mirrored the complaint with the circuit court, and there's nothing in there about the agency agreement or lack of a new one. Now, when the commission got a hold of it and filed their complaint, it was contained in there. But again, it was not a main issue. The issue was always the 240 acres and the maps on the boundaries and the incorrect boundaries. So to that extent, Mr. Leonard didn't have an opportunity to fully present his side. And since my time is getting limited, I do want to point out that if, in fact, this court disagrees with the trial court and does not believe there is an assignment, we ask that it be remanded for a determination with respect to the costs and fine. There's no question, first of all, that the costs are assessed inappropriately. They were over $6,000, and that amount was spent towards prosecuting both Mr. Niederwerder and Mr. Leonard. And certainly they'd have to separate out what's associated with Mr. Leonard versus Mr. Niederwerder.
Was there ever an opportunity to object to that at the agency level?
No, there was not. And I will point out, too, that $625 of that amount was for Mr. Wolkin to drive from his home in Arkansas to attend. And again, Mr. Wolkin never had this issue with regard to the agency agreement. And in addition to the $6,000, there was a fine of $1,000. And as I stated earlier, at most, at the very most, this is a technical violation. And under the Dale versus South Dakota Real Estate Commission case, that would not be consistent, that comparison between a $1,000 fine and a very technical violation, if any. And unless there are any other questions, we ask that the court consider all of the facts in this case as the trial court did and affirm the trial court.
Thank you, Ms. Lammers-Bogart. Okay, Ms. Ryder-Rapp, you have 10 minutes.
I'd like to go back to Ms. Bogart's comment about Mr. Wolkin never complaining about this part of it. That's part of the reason why I talked about what the Real Estate Commission's charge is, because sometimes we have individuals that aren't as knowledgeable about what the law is as those that are actually in the profession themselves that have to take the continuing education. They know what the law is. They know what the requirements are under the law. A person without that experience, and I would argue a person that has done, you know, 3 to 4 sales in their lifetime isn't necessarily an experienced person, but if we do accept that argument that he was experienced, that does not forgive Mr. Leonard from going through with his client what the relationship is. And it's more than just saying this is a dual agency relationship. It's explaining what that dual agency relationship means. In actual dual agency relationships are kind of a peculiar breed, and I remember my dad saying that he was kind of surprised actually when that passed the legislature that the realtor was able to represent both sides of the transaction. But because they are able to represent both sides of the transaction, I think it's particularly important that there is this informed written consent. And Mr. Wolkin did not know or did not understand the gamut of that relationship. I mean, here you have Rapid Realty acting on behalf of Walter Dale Miller. You have them acting on behalf of Rusty Engesser. And then you have Rapid Realty acting on behalf of Daniel Wolkin. I mean, they're representing everybody to this transaction. That is precisely why there needs to be this informed written consent that the statute requires. And it doesn't matter that Daniel Wolkin, a layperson, did not include this in his complaint to the commission. Because when the commission received this complaint, they saw that this, too, was a violation of the licensing laws, and they included that in their complaint that was before the administrative body. Mr. Leonard clearly had due process. I mean, this was a part of the complaint that was before the commission. He had an opportunity, a fair hearing, where he presented his arguments as to why he didn't think that he was required to have or execute this new agency agreement, because he believed that the assignment took care of that. And I think, I don't know who asked this question, but whose obligation is it? It's clearly the licensee's obligation. It's not the consumer's obligation to make sure that the licensee complies with the law. It's the licensee's duty to do that.
This is almost really the it's a little different than the attorney-client agreement, because here you're really assigning your own knowledge to somebody else, aren't you? I mean, you've written you're saying informed consent, and you can't assign your own understanding of the informed consent. That's what you're arguing. I mean, it's a little different than the relationship as opposed to the consent.
Well, and I would agree with that. I guess the analogy that I was trying to make is that in both types of relationships, they involve this personal confidence, this personal trust.
And this also involves knowledge about what...
Yes. And I think, the case that was cited, the Carter v. State, kind of, it shows, in the case, the difference between the two. Because in Carter v. State, you had, it was a contract for the printing of some reports. I mean, clearly, and it even said in the case, that that's a situation that it doesn't really matter who does the printing. In fact, the only requirement in that particular case, as far as the bidding was, had to be a reputable, agency, and it went to the lowest bidder. That's different here. I mean, a person, when they're making the decision to sell their home or to sell 2,200 acres of ranch land, and it's worth a lot of money, they're going to the person that they feel like they can trust. And so it is. It's a fiduciary type of relationship, one involving personal trust, personal services, and it's not properly assignable. And as far as the costs are concerned, just addressing that part of it, the commission clearly has the ability to recover their cost as a part of a proceeding. And frankly, Gary Niederwerder and Gary Niederwerder and Mr. Leonard, the complaint that was filed against both entities or both individuals, but they both were a part of Rapid Realty. And the cost, frankly, it was a situation where I'm not sure you can differentiate the cost because the complaint was lodged against both of them, and I'm not sure how you would separate those out.
Go ahead. Is there any opportunity to challenge the cost at the administrative level? Or does it just come out as their findings and it goes in the order? Normally you can challenge costs like in a regular court proceeding. There's a process?
Well, no, not necessarily a process, I guess. I mean, you're right in the sense that it is included in the final order. Sometimes we have discussions, but as far as a formalized process.
Is there any opportunity for them to object to it at that level and then have a hearing just on the cost?
Since I've been with the commission, we've never done that. But I don't know for certain if in the past they've been able to do that.
You argue that you can't separate them. Shouldn't that be a decision the commission makes, yes or no, you can or cannot separate these costs? Otherwise, how do we know how much is attributable to Mr. Niederwerder and how much is attributable to Mr. Leonard?
And I would agree that that would be a question that would probably be better to be answered by the commission than this court. I just wanted to make sure they had a chance to address that issue. And then as far as the fine is concerned, the commission has the ability to assess actually a $2,500 fine, and they assessed a $1,000 fine, and I guess I would dispute Mr. Leonard's claim that it was a technical violation of the law. So I have nothing further. Thank you.
Court will be in recess.